It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to best-selling American author Chuck Palahniuk about his latest novel, Doomed.
But first, an amendment to Wisconsin's constitution would make it harder to recall state and local office holders.
If the amendment passes, politicians could only be recalled if they were charged with a felony or an ethics violation.
This potential constitutional change just passed the Wisconsin Assembly's Elections Committee, making it one step closer to being a reality.
And we'll take your calls on this in just a few minutes. Join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should it be harder to recall elected officials in Wisconsin? Or do you not like the idea? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mordecai Lee joins us now. He's a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, what do we know so far about this proposed constitutional amendment?
Well, the proposed constitutional amendment is trying to thread the needle very carefully because what's left unstated is that in Wisconsin, anybody, any elected official who's convicted of a felony automatically loses office. And so when you think about what the proposal tries to cover, there isn't that much room. And they're talking about accused of a crime or accused of an ethics violation. I think we can easily understand that just because somebody is accused of something doesn't necessarily make them guilty of something. And that sort of leads me to the more general point, and one that Rob is familiar with from my earlier conversations with him, and that's that I'm philosophically against recalls. It's hard for me to think of a situation that would justify a recall. And in part, I suppose that's one of the flaws of this constitutional amendment, and that's that, well, they're going to lose office if they're convicted of a felony anyway.
Well, give us a little bit of a sense of the why behind this, then, given that you automatically lose your office if you're convicted of a felony. Why do we need this?
I think that's arguable. I'm against recalls, period. It seems to me that recalls take us more towards a kind of a parliamentary form of government, where governments rise and fall on an unpredictable basis, and that the American form of government is based on fixed terms. And in fact, it was interesting to me that when Governor Walker was facing a recall, there were a layer of voters who were answering public opinion polls who were saying that, well, they're not sure they agreed with Act 10, they're not sure they agreed with the record of Governor Walker, but they were against recalling him. And I sort of like that spot. That's a good spot to be in, from my personal opinion. Now, just because I'm a professor of government, that doesn't make my opinion more right than anybody else. And I certainly hope that we'll have some calls, people saying that recall is always justified. And the last thing I'd add is that going back into Wisconsin history, why is it that our Constitution includes a section that does permit recalls? That really goes back to the La Follette Progressive era, where what they were mostly afraid of was people who would run for office and get elected as progressives. And then once they got to Madison, they would flip and become sort of pro-business conservative Republicans. In those days, they were called stalwarts. And so there was a kind of an ideological background to why they liked recalls. It wasn't so much oriented towards misbehavior in office.
Well, what are the Democrats saying? I get the sense that the argument against this is that it would limit the rights of citizens and that we need this leverage in our democracy as a failsafe.
I think you're right, Veronica. You've really put your finger on it. That's going to be the argument, and that's that if people are elected, then they should be subject to recall, that if public opinion changes, if they do something people don't like, then they should be recalled. And absent this constitutional amendment, using the current language of the Constitution, there's no need to give an explanation for the reason of the recall. In other words, there's no threshold that you have to cross. And that's as it applies to state elected offices and I believe to federal members of Congress. When it comes to recalls in Wisconsin for local elected officials, that's subject not to the Constitution, but to a statute, to a law. And under the current law, indeed, for example, I think it's school board members, you have to give a reason that has to be justified in a court if challenged.
Well, how do you expect this to proceed? I gather that the road ahead would be long for this to actually go into effect.
Well, I guess I'm being an idealistic or naive professor in the sense that I would hope for a constitutional amendment that would ban all recalls. But that's probably just not pragmatic. It seems to me that we indeed have to look at the merits of this proposal, and that's that given that in Wisconsin an elected official who's convicted of a felony loses office, is this particular tinkering with the constitutional language worthwhile? And I suspect it's going to be a pretty close call because of the obvious scenario. Let's say somebody is accused of a felony, gets recalled, then gets acquitted in court, and they're out of office. Is that sort of fair? My general belief is that, you know, nobody's going to get away with anything. For example, if Governor Walker hadn't been recalled, then anyway his run for re-election would have been essentially a referendum on his record, including Act 10. And so I rarely see that there's ever a justification for a recall in general.
Do you think it's constitutional? I'm not a scholar of the Wisconsin Constitution, but tell me about, and you know, to say nothing of the bigger issues, but is it something that could be challenged legally?
I suspect not, in the sense that anything that's in the Constitution, by definition, is likely to be constitutional. Now, that sort of sounds like a tautology, but I suppose there are occasionally situations, maybe when there's a state constitutional amendment that, let's say, infringes on a federal constitutional language, that would probably be the most likely scenario where it could happen. Otherwise, constitutional amendments, by definition, are constitutional.
I guess that makes sense. All right, let's go to the calls now. We've got full lines. Sarah joining us in Manitowoc. Hey, Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I am against the amendment. I think that there needs to be your procedure to keep things in a check and balance, and that people need to have this right to get rid of someone who is incompetent, abuses their power, or for some other, you know, egregious behavior. The procedure is not all that easy. It hasn't taken place all that often, and I think, you know, I think there does need to be a recall procedure in some extreme cases, you know, and it just seems like there's a lot of amendments coming down the way that's out of Madison lately that seem to curtail people's rights. And for a party that's in charge that doesn't want government interference, they seem to be having a far reach into everything.
Okay, thanks for the comment, Sarah. What would you say to that, Mordecai?
Well, I'm really glad she called because she made the case for why people like the ability to recall. And I guess in opposition, what I'd say is that I think recall has become too common in Wisconsin. Up until the 1970s, it was in the Constitution, it was in the statutes, but it was almost never heard of until a judge in Dane County got recalled. And then it became just sort of the currency of the day. That we've seen school boards and village boards sort of recalled or threatened to be recalled sort of at the drop of a hat. And so in that sense, I like what Sarah said, that in extreme cases, maybe there's a justification for it. But generally speaking, issues in politics are controversial, and then somebody has a record, and 2 years later, 4 years later, they run for re-election, they're held accountable. Nobody really gets away with anything.
Okay, thanks for that call, and we'll move next to Kyle joining us in Hazel Green. Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm in favor of it. I know I was in college during the Scott Walker thing, so a lot of that was happening. I sort of got caught up in it, but once I look back on it, I think politicians do need, you know, like 2 or 4 years, and they shouldn't be afraid that they're going to get recalled if they do something that's not necessarily popular. Because sometimes that's good for our country in the long run. So I think it's a good idea that they don't get recalled because I think elections are for that purpose, for if we want those people in office or not.
So. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Kyle. And Mordecai, just to build on Kyle's argument, you know, we're in a very polarized era of government right now. That's a given. But we saw how damaging these recalls could be and how costly. Is there something to that argument that, you know, we don't have time for this or emotional capital?
Well, I'm really glad Kyle called because that means at least one of your listeners agrees with me. But I can tell you, some of your listeners know that before I became a professor, I was a state senator. And I can tell you that back in those long ago times of the 1980s, one of the most controversial issues was the drinking age. And I happen to come from the generation of the 60s, and I voted against increasing the drinking age. And I think if the culture of recalls had existed at the time, I probably would have been recalled. And As it turned out, 2 years later, at the end of my state Senate term, when I was running for re-election, the issue had faded, and I was successfully re-elected. So in that respect, Kyle is really putting his finger on it. Some issues are hot at the moment, but in the balance of the larger record of an incumbent, they're not necessarily fatal.
Can you put Wisconsin in context? How many other states have this recall mechanism?
Oh, God, I probably should have looked that up before we talked. I think it's about half. It's much more common in the later states, the western states, than it is in the eastern states, and very much came out of the progressive reforms of the 1910s and 1920s. So those later states have it much more often than those earlier states.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, and we will take Marie next in Bayview. Hi, Marie.
Hello there. Hi. I think that a lot of damage can be done in 4 years, as evidenced by Scott Walker. Anyway, there's got to be some way for the public to say, maybe not a recall, maybe a referendum, some way for people to say, no, we don't like that law.
Okay, well, thank you for your comment, Marie.
Right.
And, yeah, what do you think, Mike?
Well, I think Marie is referring to something that's, I think it's Ohio and maybe also Michigan, where there's the potential of, this sort of sounds odd, recalling a law. And I think what had happened in Ohio, and I hope somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, is there was something that was a little bit like Act 10 that got passed by the state legislature. It was a Republican legislature, Republican governor. And then following through on this recall of a law, there were enough petition signers to have a referendum on the law. And as a result, the law was overturned. I guess I'd prefer that to recalling individuals. But in general, I just like the idea of fixed terms.
Let's get a Facebook comment in. This is Sarah on Facebook who says, the recall or doing away with the recall as we have it now is like an employee saying, I'm putting it in my contract that you can't fire me, and then the employer has no choice in the matter.
Well, I suppose there's a situation where people do have a kind of incumbency in the private sector or in the unelected sector. But if we're talking about elected officials, the longest term in Wisconsin politics is 10 years, and that's the state Supreme Court. Otherwise, we have 6-year terms for judges, 4-year terms for governors and for state senators, 2-year terms for state reps. So it's not that they'd get to stay in office for a long time if they really abused their office. I think that 2, 4, 6 years is a short enough period to hold people accountable.
And Mordecai, one last question for you. How likely do you think it is that this amendment will pass in Wisconsin?
I think that the Republican majority would like to limit recalls, but I think that they're going to bump up against the comments that I made at the beginning of our conversation, and that's that short of actually eliminating the right of recall from the Constitution, that this kind of tinkering around the edges probably doesn't do much and might do a little bit of harm and sort of might take away the opportunity to do the kind of more fundamental revision that they'd like. So if I had to make a guess, and this is purely a guess, it's probably not going to reach the voters eventually.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee.
Coming up next, best-selling novelist Chuck Palahniuk joins us to talk about his latest book, Doomed. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Chuck Palahniuk is a best-selling American novelist, probably best known for his book Fight Club, which was turned into a film.
Well, he's got a new book out now. It's called Doomed. It's a follow-up novel to Damned, about a 13-year-old girl damned to hell. And he's coming to Milwaukee this weekend. We'll have some more details about that coming up. Chuck Palahniuk, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for letting me yak about my book.
Well, before we get to the book, I want to talk about this gig in Milwaukee. When I think about a book reading, I think a calm event where there's a little talking and a little reading, maybe there's tea. You do these things a little differently. What happens at a Chuck Palahniuk reading?
Well, number one, most of the people who come to my readings have never been to an author event, and I want to make sure that their first one is fantastic. They're also going to be generally younger readers, people in their teens or their 20s. So this go-around, I've corralled a couple writer friends, Chelsea Kane, who is famous for her heartsick thriller series, Chelsea Kane, and another writer, Monica Drake, who is kind of an underground cult sensation, but she has a new book out called The Stud Book, and she has always been kind of a hero for me. Monica Drake's writing is brilliant. And the three of us put together what we call adult bedtime stories. We wanted a kind of presence that being read to quality that we had as children that made us want to learn how to read ourselves. And if you'd like, I can launch into some of the particulars of this year's event, or I can let you toss it back to you.
No, go for it. I believe pajamas are on the agenda, right?
Everyone is encouraged to wear pajamas. So, for example, in Tulsa 2 nights ago, we had 900-plus people in pajamas. In the downtown Tulsa library that was about to be demolished, they gave it to us for 1 night. And people were allowed to write or paint anything, anywhere. And I provide hundreds and hundreds of these 2-foot diameter beach balls that are white, but they have a pocket inside. And once the audience members blow them up, they insert light sticks inside of them. So periodically, we shut off all the lights, so the venue is pitch dark. And as people throw these around, it is just breathtaking. And we do it several times throughout the evening for a minute or two at a time as part of this overall game that encompasses the evening. And if people would like to see some idea of how this looks, participants are already posting video clips online and in photographs. I think Chelsea Kane's site has got quite a few, and there are some fan sites of mine, chuckpolonick.net, or The Cult, where they're posting video and pictures of this this glowing ball effect where everyone is basically playing dodgeball with these huge glowing orbs in the pitch dark.
Wow. So it's kind of almost like a reading / rave.
Exactly. There's all of these glow-in-the-dark LED things involved and prizes and contests and readings. Chelsea reads, I read, Monica reads. And so it is just a constantly changing texture of things for about an hour and a half.
I want to ask about something. I've heard a rumor, and maybe it's an urban legend, maybe it's not, but supposedly one of your stories you've done at readings in the past, a previous collection, people, it was so gruesome or shocking that they passed out without benefit of heavy drinking.
That is a famous story now. It was called Guts. Mm-hmm. And I was always so impressed by Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, and how when The Lottery was published in The New Yorker, hundreds of people canceled their subscriptions in the 1950s. They were so offended by The Lottery. And I thought, what would a story have to do these days to be just as shocking as The Lottery had been? And so I wrote this sort of 3-act short story. I think it's 9 pages. And my friends in workshop, including Monica and Chelsea, they both laughed at it, and they laughed a lot. But from its first reading, we've had almost a fainter at every single public reading.
Wow.
And people report that they fainted sitting in cars reading it to themselves. And I've seen people standing in line at book signings read it silently and faint. One man fainted on a subway platform while he was reading it.
Yeesh.
And so I've seen personally at least 72 people faint, and that's where I quit counting. At least 200 people have fainted at public readings of the story.
Is that a badge of honor for you as an author?
I think it's a badge of honor for storytelling, that just someone saying some words that are very funny on the front end but then get very dark by the end of the story. Just words can have that kind of effect. You know, I think about storytelling around campfires and how thrilling that was. And I would love to create that for adults, bring back that thrill of just hearing a story that you were so completely present to.
And would you say, I mean, apart from Guts, is that a central point in your writing, trying to create that experience?
Trying to create a very strong experience. And the story I read this year is called Zombies, and by the end it has people weeping. It sounds like a tuberculosis ward toward the end. Out in the darkness, I hear all these people sniffing and clearing their throats, and so many people are crying by the end. But just to have that strong effect so that people aren't sitting there being bored.
We're talking to author Chuck Palahniuk, and after the news, we're going to start talking about his new book. It's called Doomed, and I've been having fun saying the title all day. Doomed is a nice word to jump in on. And you can jump in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a fan? Have you been one of those people, one of the 200-plus people who passed out at a reading of that story? Do you have questions you'd like to ask him? 800-642-1234.
You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Chuck Palahniuk. His new book is Doomed. You might know him from books like Fight Club and a lot of other ones. He's coming to Wisconsin. He'll be in Milwaukee Saturday at 7 at the UW-Milwaukee Union in the Wisconsin Room. You can get tickets and more information at boswell.indiebound.com. We'll have a link on the Central Time Facebook page as well. Well, Chuck, I want to get into Doomed now. It's a sequel to Damned. And, all right, let's look at your protagonist. She's your typical 13-year-old girl, overweight, snarky, and dead. So how do you capture that voice?
So it's a voice that has been kind of exposed to everything in the world because her parents are so wealthy and so celebrated. And in a way, she must dismiss everything, if only to kind of resist being constantly dragged in the wake of this big, glamorous comet that is her mom and dad.
And she tells her story in a kind of a electronic way. She calls it a blog exactly. It's like a BBS. She's answering questions from, I think, the living. Why did you have her be an electronic communicator in this?
Well, I need to keep in the second book, she's basically in limbo. She's back on Earth, but as a ghost. And I needed to keep all the characters from the first book, where she was in hell, I needed to keep them present. So she is actually interacting and responding to comments that they post from hell. And that's how we keep all the characters from the what will eventually be a three-book series, keep them all present.
And she's in the real world, but it's her purgatory, her limbo now. Talk about the world we live in as a kind of limbo.
Right, and in the first book, she very well intentionally told her parents to do very specific things so that their family would be reunited. They would be condemned to hell, but at least they would be together forever. And she told them that doing those things would cause them to be put into heaven, where they fervently believe that she is.
So she's misleading them
exactly
into the wrong direction.
And since they're celebrities, they thought that they would save the entire world by passing along this knowledge. And so, in fact, they have damned the entire world.
And your protagonist, Madison, actually, named after Madison, Wisconsin, I can only assume, she talks in, I think, self-consciously shocking way. And she talks about in her living years, or pre-dead years, I'm sorry, I think she calls it, being this, trying to have this tough, almost streetwise, salty persona. And is that age of 13 before you hit the teen years, was that kind of the key, that tween zone that she's telling it from?
The tween zone, and also that, her language and the way she talks is more of a costume than anything else. Hmm. And so she gets more things wrong than she gets right. She thinks she knows a lot more than she actually does.
And there's a great bit where she's addressing the pre-dead who want to be in contact with dead people. And basically the gist is, hey, we're dead. We're not at the beck and call of every darn Ouija board in the world. I'm paraphrasing. But do you imagine that if there are ghosts out there, that the last thing they want to do is come every time we whip out that Ouija board?
Well, no. And the fact that they are so often misinterpreted, like her parents have completely misinterpreted what she was trying to communicate. And so it seems like every time we get a message from the other side, we get it wrong.
And so telling the story of this character, you actually, so before the book came out, you had a little spoiler. A lot of authors are worried about spoiler alerts, and you had a note something like, by the way, the world ends in this one. How is that not a spoiler that you'd want to keep from people?
Well, you know, at least if you know where it's going, I think there are far more shocking things that happen in the book than that. So in a way, I was giving that one away for free, but there's much better payoffs than that.
Now, there's a young adult protagonist, and I think people are watching this and looking around at reviews. People are wondering, well, is this YA fiction? And my read on it is probably not. Would you put it in a YA category?
Not necessarily. You know, it uses a lot of euphemisms, and Madison's very specific wrong language for things. But if anything, it's either adult or it's what they're now calling new adult fiction, which is young adult fiction, but just a lot racier.
And at the beginning, you talk about this as what the classic story, all of our stories are about good and evil. Is The Damned and Doomed, the first two books in the trilogy, this is ultimately about good and evil?
It is. And ultimately, in the third book, which is kind of the heaven book, she's going to pursue a line of theology from, I think it was the 15th century, where people became obsessed with the idea that if human beings could matchmake and patch up the relationship between Satan and the devil, kind of like in The Parent Trap where Haley Mills tries to get her parents back together, you know, all of us children of the 70s, that was our dream, to kind of do a Haley Mills trick and bring our mom and dad back into loving each other. But Madison figures out a way to bring Satan and God back together and thus resolve all conflict in all of creation.
Not bad for a dead 13-year-old. So you're going from hell to purgatory to heaven. I didn't come up with this myself. It was pointed out elsewhere, following the pattern of Dante.
Right, and also following the pattern of Gulliver's Travels, which is three travel books. Hmm. So in a way, I'm just doing travel writing. And I see Gulliver's Travels and this and Voyage of the Beagle as just different forms of travel writing.
Well, we mentioned earlier, you're also the author of Fight Club, made into a movie that did fairly well. How did you like the realization? Did you like how the movie captured what you wrote?
I thought it was the movie was terrific. It was so faithful for the most part. And it depicted literally some things that people had said could not be depicted in the movie.
Right, yeah. A lot of people said, I seem to recall, this is a book you can't make a movie out of before
exactly.
The movie came out. And
right.
You think they did it.
And so that's it's really a tribute to David Fincher.
And what did that do for your career as an author?
You know, it was such a slow build. The book didn't really catch on, and then the movie came out, and the movie took years to find an audience. And so between the slow build of the book and the slow build of the movie, I didn't really notice. You know, it was such a slow upward sales.
A lot of people might object to being labeled as a cult author or having a cult following. You mentioned earlier that one of your biggest fan groups with a website actually calls itself The Cult. You're okay with the cult label?
I'm fine with that. You know, it was such an overused term that it's kind of lost all of its power.
But do you interact with the cult and those devoted fans much?
I do, and really what I try to do is encourage people to take on their own writing. And I try to pass along things that I've learned as a writer that I wish I had learned much earlier. A couple summers, every other summer, I teach up in Seattle. But it's more about kind of focusing people on their own work rather than drawing more attention to myself.
Was there somebody like that for you that led you into a career of writing that gave you at least some of the impetus to get into it?
There is a man named Tom Spanbauer who lives in Portland. And he started giving writing workshop lessons every Thursday in his kitchen. And so me and I think, two other students, including Monica Drake, who reads with me on tour, started paying $20 every Thursday to present our work and discuss our work. And now Tom's workshop is gigantic.
Do you go back to the workshop ever, now that you're a successful author?
I do occasionally, but it really is so huge. It really it fills this entire house.
Now, looking at your work, a lot of people say there's a lot of shock value there. I think I've heard you say that you view it as, in part, your job to, I'll clean up language, tick people off a little. Why is that an important role for you as an author?
Well, I want to look at what are the strengths of books. And right now, one of the strengths that books have as a storytelling form is that they're able to depict things that movies can't depict, and music can't depict, and television certainly can't depict, because their production budgets are so huge, and because they need to literally show things to audiences that might not be consenting to consume those images, where a book has the complete license to depict things, because you have to be educated, and you're making an ongoing effort and consenting as you're reading. So I think the book should really tackle tough images, tough situations, things that the other media just can't touch. And right now, that's one of the few strengths that books still have.
We're talking to author Chuck Palahniuk. We've talked a little bit about his newest novel, Doomed. He's the author of Fight Club and a number of other books as well. And he's coming to Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee this Saturday. We'll pick up the conversation in just a couple moments.
You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're speaking with best-selling American author Chuck Palahniuk. He's the author of Fight Club. His newest book is Doomed, second book in a series that started with Damned. We've been talking about some of his work. And now, Chuck, a game we like to play when we have authors and musicians on is to talk about what they're reading and listening to. So apart from the people traveling with you on this book tour, who are you reading these days and having a lot of fun with?
I am reading The Galleys of a New Biography about Burroughs, called Call Me Burroughs, the man who wrote Naked Lunch.
Mm-hmm. William Burroughs, yeah.
Yes.
And what is it? Is this a character, a real-life character that you're into?
Well, I'm kind of obsessed with reading biographies about writers because they make me feel a little better about how badly my life can go. And before that, I just finished reading Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, the biography about David Foster Wallace.
Oh, okay. So do you, when you're reading their biographies, does it seem like, oh, they've got this really interesting narrative in their lives, but I don't know, whenever I think about my life, it doesn't feel like that narrative, like there could be a biography about me. Is there that jarring disjunction?
Oh, I hope so, because their lives were train wrecks.
Right, William Burroughs, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, and Foster Wallace's life wasn't much smoother.
And any fiction that you are reading lately that jumps out at you?
One book I'm always going back to is a fantastic collection of short stories by a Korean-American writer named Naomi Moon. And I hope I'm saying her name right. Naomi, N-A-M-I, Moon, M-U-N. But also I would recommend Monica Drake's The Stud book and Chelsea Kane's new book, which title I can't remember, in the Heartsick series, Chelsea Kane,
okay.
Any of the books. Start from the first one, Heartsick.
And they'll both be with you at that event in Milwaukee, as you mentioned earlier.
They sure will.
Let's talk a little more about David Foster Wallace and every love story is a ghost story. Do you think he's been too celebrated, too lionized since his death?
You know, it's hard to say because he had really kind of fallen into disdain before his death. So it's as if we've done a huge correction in maybe focusing too much attention. But also there is the factor of a lot of people getting to profit from his death. So a lot of people bringing things to market and a lot of money being made, you know, because of his death. The factor of kind of praising this person who we had started to ridicule, but also the factor of making money to do so.
if somebody were writing a biography about you now, what key things, maybe even something shocking, would you want to have in there to help them, help us understand your work as an author?
I think mine would be very boring. My degree is in journalism, and most of my work consists of kind of harvesting stories from other people and finding ways to turn them into fiction. So most of my life is interviewing people who read my books and then putting their stories in books and selling those stories back to them.
I've seen you talk about the idea of minimalism as a key part of, or a key theme in at least some of your books. Talk about minimalism in your writing.
Now, this is my understanding of minimalism via Tom Spanbauer, the writer in whose workshop I started. And Tom studied with Gordon Lish at Columbia in New York in the 1980s, a kind of golden age with Amy Hempel and Mark Richard and those fantastic writers. Lish was also the editor for What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. Raymond, who am I thinking of?
Carver?
Raymond Carver,
Carver,
yes.
Yeah.
So, according to Tom, with minimalism, there are very specific rules. Not using verbs that are kind of cerebral verbs like think, believe, hope. Using only verbs that are very concrete verbs, not using Latinate language, really fancy language, really unpacking every moment in a very cinematic way without using abstractions. You can never say it was a 100-degree day. You could never say the man was 6 feet tall, because 6 feet occurs differently for everyone. And when you use an abstraction, you kind of shortchange the reader from the experience of how the narrator perceives a six-foot-tall man. So no abstractions, no Latinates, no thought verbs. I could give you 100 rules.
All right. Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Hey, Rob, thank you so much yourself.
Yeah, have a great visit to Wisconsin.
Hey, come down and see the balls fly.
All right. That was Chuck Palahniuk. He is the author of the new novel, Doomed. And as I mentioned earlier, he'll be at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Union Saturday at 7. That's sponsored by Boswell Book Company. You can get information about that event at boswell.indiebound.com and get ready to bat a glowing beach ball around at the event, evidently.